From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, how the Strange Fruit Music Festival in Milwaukee seeks to use music to address race relations.
Later, a farm-to-table dinner honors some of the high school students who worked the land.
It's quite an amazing thing to see something grow from a seed to all the way to producing it, helping it grow, watering it, and harvesting, logging it, selling it to market, and sharing it with the community.
A Whitefish Bay woman's recent book tries to help parents get their kids ready to leave the nest with some basic realities.
And musician Trapper Shep explains how the Zippin' Pippin' at Bay Beach Amusement Park inspired a song on his new album.
I wrote it repeatedly, over and over, and with each kind of pass, more lyrics came to me, and I set the song to that clickety-clack rhythm.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. For the second year, the Strange Fruit Festival is returning to Milwaukee. Named for the 1939 song made famous by Billie Holiday, Strange Fruit is a festival dedicated to exploring race relations through music and art. The fest opens tonight at the Washington Park Bandshell and will continue at various venues through Friday.
Musician Jay Anderson is one of the founders of the Strange Fruit Music Festival, and he joined us in studio to talk about it. Jay, thanks so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Of course.
So just to kind of start off here, what is sort of the mission of the Strange Fruit Festival?
Well, the first year is more of a socially retaliatory gathering. You know, it's very upsetting, some of the things that were going on in the country at the time. And that's not quite the most sustainable way to shape a movement.
When you say socially retaliatory, what do you mean by that?
Well, the original Strange Fruit Festival was in response to some of the shootings that had been happening across the nation. And the original thought behind the festival was more so of, this is not acceptable. And we're musicians, so we use our music to express how unacceptable it is. And so that's what I mean by socially retaliatory. This year, between last year and this year, I did some traveling, and I spent a good chunk of my time in the South, particularly in New Orleans and the Louisiana area. And when I noticed how things were treated there with race, with the state of the country, then I wanted to change the objective of the festival to be more so of a celebration of mutual understanding and communication and diasporic cultures.
What was it about your trip to the South that made you want to change the mission statement from something that was, as you said, socially retaliatory to something that was more of a celebration?
Because it was Lundi Gras, and I was on Decatur. And I'm looking around, and everyone's getting kind of crazy. It's the night before Mardi Gras, and it's just, they ramp up to it. And I saw a black man on the street and a white cop. And the white cop had a really big gun, a huge gun. It looked like a military-grade gun that he had. It's like almost like riot police, because they can get kind of crazy. And this guy's starting on this drama with them, and this guy shoves him. He shoves the cop. And I'm kind of, my antennas go up like, oh, whoa, this is, I just kind of froze. And then the cop leans his head back and he says to him, hey man, I'm not trying to do this with you today. This is the worst night of the week to work. I'm trying to go home and get off my shift early. You don't want bullets, I don't want paperwork, going somewhere. Go sit down. And I told my host in New Orleans, Arsène Delay, what I had seen. She's like, oh yeah, we don't do that here. Nobody down here plays at this mess about like, mm-mm. And so that's when I was like, okay, there needs to be more of an understanding. As opposed to an argument.
Now, how does your festival work to do that? So Strange Fruit Festival, it's a lot of musicians, right? It's some artists. How does it work to create a larger dialogue?
Because everybody wants to be fans of everyone's music. But all of the musicians are human as well. And these are things that we're thinking about as well. So the point is to bring everyone into the same room. So that you actually have to think about it. if you go see De La Buena or the Kevin Hayden Band, if you go see No Seatbelts or you go see Bow and Arrow, you might just be going to see them at a show. But it reframes the context that you are listening in as an audience member if you're seeing them at a festival that is based around having the conversation about race. Then you're seeing them in a different light, in a different context. And so that's how the festival is built out to work. It's not so much that you ask them about it after the show, or you read like a blog post or a Facebook post that somebody makes after something happens. They are there for the express reason of joining the conversation. And that is the foremost, even to the performance.
Now, the name of the festival, of course, is in and of itself a reference to, I don't know, race relations. For people who might not understand the reference, can you sort of explain where the name Strange Fruit stems from?
Of course. Billie Holiday did not write the song, but she made it very popular with her rendition of it. And it seemed like the perfect name for the festival because she's using music to address racial relations. And that is exactly what we're doing. You could summarize the entire mission statement into that one sentence, is that we're using music to address racial relations. And that's what Billie Holiday did with that song. So it just seemed like a no-brainer when it came up in our discussion of what is the name.
Strange Fruit, of course, was a response to a photograph from, I believe, Marion, Indiana.
Yeah.
And maybe one of the only known lynching survivors, James Cameron, who founded America's Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee, was, of course, the other man who was supposed to be, in theory, in that photo. Did you know about those kinds of Milwaukee ties when you came up with the name, like the James Cameron tie to Strange Fruit?
I was made aware of it, and it was just incredibly interesting. But the more that I study the history of Milwaukee and the history of the migration from the South, the more everything makes more and more sense with the connections.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you go back and you look and you look at what happened in the South, then you saw that there was a lot of immigration to the North, then you saw a lot of business happening with historically black colleges, then you saw a lot of gerrymandering in the areas. Once there's this progression, it's not, none of this is some grand mystery. You know, if you want to sit down and open some books and talk to your agriculture professors, you know, then you can see there's a very clear lineation of how it happened. So when I found that out before, I found it very interesting, but my dad's side of the family is from Gary, Indiana, you know, and they're there because someone moved up from the South however many generations ago. So that's what I mean by that.
Okay. So this is, of course, the second year of the festival, and last year's festival happened right around the time of the uprising in Sherman Park. What was it like producing that festival with that event, you know, in the background of everyone's minds?
Well, actually, Sherman Park happened during the second night of the festival. Venus Williams was giving a statement and speaking to an audience on the patio of Company Brewing about how she shouldn't have to be concerned about whether or not her son or her husband or her nephews or her family members are going to make it home at nighttime. And she's giving this powerful speech, and the people are taking their cell phones out. And I'm kind of looking around, and I'm producing the event, and I'm looking around, and I'm very curious as to why are any of you on your phones while she's giving this address. And then Jared English from the ACLU steps over to my left-hand side, and he says, Jay, Sherman Park is on fire right now. And then everyone stopped, and there was an announcement made. And then some of the people who needed to go and check on their neighborhood left to go do that. And then the people who chose to stay behind as we processed everything that was happening in that moment.
What was that experience like?
There is nothing to compare it to. There's nothing at all in my life to compare it to. I suppose one of the things that was amazing about that experience is that the people who left because either they live there or they have friends who live there or they have family who live there they wanted to check on. the people say behind, it was one of the strongest and one of the most natural bonding moments I think I've ever seen in my life. Because nobody knew what to do. Nobody knew where to go, you know? It's not like we're in the middle of it, but it's not, who's so someone running over there to help? Is someone staying back? Is someone making phone calls? Everybody in the audience was kind of shocked and stunned and then just kind of coagulated, you know, and stuck together. And then even on the third night, the same people were there, and it was almost kind of like we made it through this weekend of music, poetry, and workshopping race. And then that happened, and it was kind of like, I remember on the third night, some of the people that I saw, and they didn't look beat down. And it wasn't so much that they looked exhausted. It looked like everyone instantly gained a deeper understanding and sympathy for each other's humanity.
We're, of course, facing more overt social and political tension than I think we've seen in a long time. And it doesn't seem to be subsiding. It only seems to be increasing, both the visibility and the tension itself. Of course, you want your festival to be a celebration, but how does it respond to what's going on right now in so many parts of the country? Charlottesville being an obvious example, but kind of everywhere.
Because a celebration is of the mutual respect for the conversation on the race situation on both sides of the coin. And so there has to be a forum in which it can be talked about. It's unfortunate that it's more visible. Actually, you know what? I can't say that. I'm actually glad for the visibility. When the 45th president was elected, a lot of people were very upset. And by no means was I happy, but I thought to myself, oh, now we're going to get to really see who stands for what and who does what. This is really going to all work its way out of the woodwork. People are going to start feeling really empowered and tied on their beliefs, and then we get to see what's going on. And so I'm thankful for the visibility, and the response in the festival is how to deal with what's in front of us. And I don't want anybody running around like with baseball bats, smashing people up. I don't want anyone. We don't need to start a race riot to deal with the visibility of these people who have already been here. Yes, the tone of the conversation has to be changed, and we have to take much more direct action than we did before. But it's through communication and conversation that we're able to keep the situation from escalating into violence. And so that is what we intend to do with the community and the conversation, the music, the art, the expression. Encourage people to keep their eyes open, be aware of your surroundings, be aware of your environment, and do your very best to sort out anything that may happen in a peaceful manner until this passes. And not to say that it will pass by us acting passively. It won't. But it has to get worse before it gets better. And I think that the visibility is a part of it getting worse before it gets better.
All right. Well, Jay Anderson, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me. And good luck with the festival.
Thank you so much.
Jay Anderson is a musician based in Milwaukee and a founder of the Strange Fruit Music Festival. The festival starts today at the Washington Park Bandshell and continues tomorrow at Gibraltar MKE and Friday at Company Brewing. There's more information about the Strange Fruit Festival at WUWM.com.
Southern trees bear strange fruit.
We'll venture out to a farm-to-table dinner with a story behind it when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Every month, we speak with Dave Kozlowski, owner of Pinehold Gardens in Oak Creek. In addition to our series on agriculture, we've discussed topics such as why he runs an organic farm, farmers markets, and the greater implications on consuming food.
For this month's segment, instead of bringing Dave into the studio, Andre Nowakowski took a trip to his farm to experience firsthand a farm-to-table dinner.
It's a sunny Sunday afternoon at Pinehold Gardens in Oak Creek as guests park off-road and make their way to a long table. Adorned with white tablecloth and wildflowers, the table is set up on the side of a field full of kale, wildflowers, and other rows and rows of produce. The occasion for this special and literal farm-to-table dinner is a fundraiser for the Racine Area Youth Farm Corps program, a branch of EcoJustice.
So we are a sponsored ministry of the Racine Dominicans. Our mission is environmental education in the context of four values: community, contemplation, creativity, and cultivation.
That's Sister Rejan Saitaki, Executive Director of the EcoJustice Center.
I'm just so excited because I think it's all about collaboration of different nonprofits working together. And it's been a wonderful relationship with David and Sandy. It started with calling David up to help ask for help putting up our hoop house. And that's how this conversation unfolded about farm to table. So, you know, and we hope to have our Youth Farm Corps come out here and actually do some work for him in his fields to kind of reciprocate down the road.
The Youth Farm Corps program employs four high school students to work on the farm, just miles away from Pinehold, for 11 weeks in the summer. A college intern serves as crew leader and mentor while the students learn the growing process from seed to harvest. Once their produce is harvested, the students are involved in marketing and learning how to prepare meals with the vegetables in order to help educate the larger community about organic farming, sustainable practices, as well as food justice. Laura Buska is this year's Youth Farm Corps leader at the EcoJustice Center, and she says that seeing all of the students' hard work come to fruition is indeed a special occasion.
It's quite an amazing thing to see something grow from a seed to all the way to producing it, helping it grow, watering it, and harvesting, logging it, selling it to market, and sharing it with the community, and to see people enjoy it and nourish them. It's a pretty amazing thing. They're learning a lot this year as well, and seeing changes in diet, trying new things that they've never even heard of before. It's a lot of growth this year, so it's very exciting.
Dave Kozlowski of Pinehold Gardens has had many farm-to-table dinners for his CSA members, but this is the first year he has partnered with EcoJustice. He explains what influenced the decision.
It is of paramount importance. That's the next generation. That's the next generation of farmers. That's the next generation of consumers, next generation of restaurant goers. So those are the kids, those are the people that we really need to introduce to this idea, because so many of us growing up, myself included being a boomer, we're not connected to farms anymore. We slipped away from that where food was made and where it was grown, and we need to bring them back in. So what they're doing with introducing them to nature and food is of paramount importance.
Devin Ingersoll and Kaylin Mason are two of the four high school EcoJustice students who were at the dinner helping to serve the meal.
Part of the food that we're using here has been actually donated from
the EcoJustice Center. About 70%, I believe?
I believe so, yeah. So, yeah, and everything that's coming from the EcoJustice Center, we have actually grown ourselves. So it's actually great to see people eat the stuff that we grew.
And how does that feel for you to see it go from your care to the table?
It's a great feeling. I love it.
Yeah. Not only did guests dine on produce that Devin and Kaylin helped to grow, but it was also prepared by the very good hands of six Milwaukee chefs, led by Chef Karen Bell of Bavette. Paul Zirkel and his wife Lisa of Good Kind Restaurant in Bayview made a kale and gorgonzola sausage served with a sweet corn, cherry tomato, and onion salad for their course. Paul says that when it came to cooking with ingredients grown by local teens, it added something a little extra special to the dish.
I mean, it doesn't go far from where we are already at, but yes, we do try a little harder because we're trying to not only impress people that have paid for a ticket here, but for the people that actually grow the food. And it always brings a little special part of the heart out, you know?
Good Kind is no stranger to using fresh, local, and seasonal ingredients in their restaurant. Zirkel notes that in today's cuisine culture, farm-to-table is to be expected.
You kind of get a sense that it's just inevitable that this is happening. You don't really hear about farm to table anymore. Restaurants are just assumed that they do that. And the quality restaurants in Milwaukee are just kind of assumed that that's what they do. And I'm glad that's gotten to that point. And I think the people, like you said, at this dinner and the people throughout the city of Milwaukee, is the West Dallas Farmers Market, the Bayview Farmers Markets, downtown Cathedral Square, it's more and more available. So there's really no excuse not to use it. You can order your stuff on Amazon, or you could get it, walk down the street and mingle and walk through a market like they do in the rest of the world.
While Milwaukee may be getting closer to the rest of the world in terms of shopping local and fresh, dinner guests Gordon and Rita Casala say that these farm-to-table fundraisers are an experience not to be taken for granted.
The first thing I'd like to say is it's really nice to get together with people from the community and spend time from a communal perspective together, sharing food, sharing a couple drinks together, and just getting to know each other more. And this is kind of special to us because these folks have kind of mentored us from time to time in terms of some of the things we've planted in our own garden. So it's really great to come here and support them.
The Farm Corps is a fun program because you maybe only have four kids a part of it, but who are they touching? And who is it going out to? So the impact is it's four kids. They maybe have two parents, so that's eight, and then their friends and their relatives. And kids need to know where our food is coming from instead of just going to the grocery store and buying things that are made somewhere else or covered in who knows what. So I think it's a great program, and this just brings it all home and brings the circle to a close.
While guests came to support EcoJustice, they also came to have an excellent meal. With their bellies full of food ranging from bread made with Red Fife heritage wheat from Caledonia's Anarchy Acres, to spiced eggplant and carrots on top of farro, to corn pudding with berries and a graham cracker crumble, the dinner came to a close with the guests serving the chefs a standing ovation. For Lake Effect, I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke with contributor Dave Kozlowski and other organizers and guests of Pinehold Gardens' EcoJustice Farm-to-Table fundraiser. You can see pictures of the event and learn more about Pinehold and the EcoJustice Center at WUWM.com.
How prepared are you for your children to leave the nest? More importantly, how prepared are they? Whitefish Bay writer Kathleen Davis tackles those questions in a recent book, which she'll talk about when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. It can be a scary world out there, especially if you're on the verge of being an empty nester, sending a child out to fend for him or herself. Maybe they're just starting their first year of college or heading off into the work world. Of course, one of the goals of parenthood is to prepare your kids for the time they leave the nest.
But as with many things, sometimes we wait until the last minute. It is with that in mind that Whitefish Bay writer Kathleen Davis wades into those subjects with a recent book called You Never Told Me That, A Crash Course in Preparing Your Kids for Independence. Kathleen Davis, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
So talk about the realization that got you to writing this book. What was the spark that got it all started for you?
Well, let's just say long nights of waking up in the middle of the night. My oldest son, who's 18 years old now, Henry, is an avid climber, but mostly climbs indoors. But he actually today, ironically, just left for British Columbia on a climbing trip by himself with his backpack. And I knew that was coming. So while he's a very smart, smart kid, he lacks some basic common sense sometimes. And so I was having these nightmares that Henry would look back at me and then just take a step off the mountain, and that was it.
And you don't have to be Freud here to see the metaphor in this.
No, you don't. And honestly, that nightmare would just happen over and over again. And so one night I just got out of bed and went to my computer and started typing down all the things I was worried about. Like, well, what am I really worried about here? Like, what do I think he can't do? Like, what, you know, like, let's try to get to the root of this.
Well, and so let's talk about that. What were the very basic things that you were concerned about that, you know, his first 17 years had not necessarily prepared him for once he left home?
Well, I think it's funny. We think about all these, you know, day-to-day things, but we don't think about the things that are really, they appear to be obvious. Like in the book, I use the example of pumping gas. You know, Henry had been filling out his college applications and, you know, he's applying to all these fantastic schools. And then he calls me from the gas pump and says, you need to drive here immediately and help me. I'm like, are you kidding? You know, what is wrong with you, child? Like, this doesn't seem like a very, you know.
This is probably not something you want to put on your college application.
Yeah, right. I'm like, don't tell Georgetown you don't know how to pump gas. I'm pretty sure it automatically eliminates you from, you know, from being able to get into the school. You know, and my instinct is to just say, like, absolutely not, I'm not coming there. Like, figure it out or don't get gas, you know.
This is, I mean, there's not a whole chapter on pumping gas, but this is, again, this is representative of something bigger, which is ability to solve small problems.
Right. Small problems, big problem, ability to just, like, face any problem. So I started thinking back to my own college experience and what were the things that I stumbled about and why, and what am I still to this day not very good at? And, you know, some of the things, again, were as basic as opening my mail versus throwing it into the corner of the kitchen countertop. And what are the ramifications for, you know, of doing that? That sounds like a very small thing, but it has a very big impact on your life. If you, you know, it can affect your credit. You can miss your, you know, best friend's wedding, you know, whatever it is. There are big ramifications for not doing that. And then, of course, the book goes into much more significant and serious topics that I think we don't address with our kids because we think it's being addressed somewhere else. We think they're just going to figure it out, or they talk with their friends about it, like consent, social media, sex in general, drinking, drugs. 20 times a day, the opportunity comes up to have these conversations, and we let that opportunity pass by.
Well, and of course, I mean, aside from social media, most of the things that you're talking about have existed for a long time. Do you think the dynamic today is any different than it was when you were 18 years old?
I'm not sure. I mean, I do think it's different. I think that the same topics and, you know, situations in some sense exist. But I think now there's just so many more formats. Like, obviously, we didn't have the same social media formats available to us then. But, you know, I think that we certainly could get ourselves into plenty of trouble when we were in college, or when we were teenagers. But now, I think that people are more cognizant of it. And I think that schools are paying more attention. Employers are paying more attention. I think the first thing employers do oftentimes is look at your social media pages when they're checking to see if they want to hire you. Colleges go to your social media to take a look at that as well.
Right. I think you're right that the concept of the permanent record was always kind of, I mean, it almost seemed like a myth when we were kids.
Right.
And today, the permanent record is there for everybody to see.
Yeah. Just, I think, I don't know, this story came out maybe a month ago, but there were 10 kids that were accepted to Harvard whose acceptances were withdrawn based on things that they put on social media. I mean, that's a pretty stiff penalty to pay for putting something stupid on social media.
Well, and so there's one of the other lessons that comes up in this is just the notion of there being consequences for one's actions.
Right. And of course, there's always been consequences for one's actions. But I don't think that kids grasp the enormity of what they are. And I think we think that, oh, they'll figure it out, but they don't. Their brains are not fully developed. They will not figure it out until that penalty is upon them. And I think you really do have to sit down and say, if this, then this. Like, if you do this, this is what could happen. And consent is a really good example of this. I did just read something recently where the laws are starting to change about consent because colleges are wanting the ability to be able to differentiate a little bit more between what was consent, what was not consent. And I think that there's so many cases of he said, she said. And so I think it's getting even more dangerous. Kids don't understand that someone changed their mind. You had a breakup. Now they're angry. And boom, there's a rape allegation. So, and it's just, you know, if you have sex, there could be, you could be asking for trouble. And I'm not saying don't have sex. I'm saying know what could happen if you decide to walk into that situation, and be smart. So.
Well, and we talked about all these other things, all these things that have existed for a long time. But when you add them to social media, it seems like there's so much room for things to go wrong. I mean, it's sort of one thing for a couple of friends to be goofing off and do something dumb in the privacy of someone's basement. But when you talk about the privacy of someone's basement, plus Facebook or Snapchat or Instagram or whatever, then suddenly you're not doing something wrong in the privacy of your own home.
Yeah, I don't know that there is the privacy of someone's basement anymore. I don't think there's the privacy of anything anymore. I think that, you know, I use the example somewhere of like, you know, and this is with a photo, so of course that's a little bit different, but you think it's the privacy of showing something to your friend, but then your friend's mother happens to see it on the phone and your friend's mother calls the police or something. Assume someone is listening or seeing at all times because they are. So you must be accountable for what you do and say.
Most of what we've talked about are kinds of things that have negative consequences. But you also, in this book, cover some things that are really much more positive, things like, you know, developing empathy in your child.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in the fact that empathy is taught. You're not necessarily born with empathy. I think that people think of it as sort of a touchy-feely thing that, like, some people have and some people don't have. And I think that you really need to sit your kids down and talk to them about developing the characteristics that you want them to have in order to be able to make decisions, in order to be able to solve problems. And I think empathy is one of the most important characteristics, because if you can teach your children to look at someone else's point of view, they can solve almost anything.
When all is said and done, how much of preparing your children, or for any of us preparing our children or whoever, to go out in the world and be independent is also wrapped up in the freedom to fail and make mistakes?
All of it. I mean, I think that I'm a big believer in failure and being allowed to fail. But I think, you know, I think that some people might say, well, if you're telling them all these things and what to do, you're not allowing them to fail. But I think it's the opposite. I think that by giving your kids the guidelines and the boundaries and all of the information, you're giving them more room to be able to go out and make decisions and do things on their own, because they have the confidence, they have the information, they can go out and feel comfortable doing things on their own. And then if they fail, that's totally fine. They're going to fail.
Well, Kathleen Davis, thank you so much for the good conversation and best of luck.
Thank you so much.
Kathleen Davis lives in Whitefish Bay. Her recent book is called You Never Told Me That, A Crash Course in Preparing Your Kids for Independence. It's her first book, and we spoke with her last month.
One more break, and then Trapper Shep celebrates a great Wisconsin amusement park with a recent album. We'll hear some of the tunes when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. There are just a few more days to hang on to that feeling of summer, whether it means a last weeknight barbecue, or a dip in the pool, or maybe a trip to the amusement park. But if you can't make it all the way to an amusement park, tonight's Tosa Tonight concert might be the next best thing.
It features Milwaukee musician and Lake Effect alum Trapper Shep on the heels of the recent release of an EP called Bay Beach Amusement Park, with 7 songs inspired by the old-school, publicly-owned amusement park in Green Bay. Trapper and his brother Tanner stopped by not too long ago to play a couple of tunes, but we start with a track from the CD called Zippin' Pippin'.
Even Elvis Presley wanted to ride. He rode it all night, a week before he died. The Zippin' Pippin'. Oh yeah. Zippin' Pippin'. It'll zip you to the left, zip you to the right. Zippin' Pippin' wanna ride with you on Saturday night.
Zippin' Pippin', Trapper Shep from the new album Bay Beach Amusement Park. Trapper Shep, Tanner Shep, both of them in the studio with us. Welcome back to the show.
Here we are.
All right, so let's get the obvious question out of the way first. What possessed you to make a concept album about an amusement park in Green Bay?
Mitch, it's all an elaborate scheme just to get free tickets to the park. That's
but,
all it is.
Tickets are free to the park anyway.
Admission is free. Tickets are 50 cents, which can get you almost any ride at the park. And as you might have heard on the Zip and Pippin, it's a buck to ride it. And how much can you get in America for a dollar these days? Not a lot.
At the same time, there are other things you can do with your hard-earned 50 cents or a dollar. What was it that originally attracted you to? I mean, how old were you when you went to Bay Beach for the first time?
Well, I was only about 21 years old, and I grew up working with Tanner at the Pierce County Fair. So you'd sit outside of the fair, and you had all the sounds of the carnival and the movement of the machinery and the kids yelling and screaming, kind of going on in your head for 8 hours a day, and while you kind of baked under the sun. So I don't know if this was some sort of strange effect of growing up just positioned outside of the amusement park for 8 hours a day or outside of the county fair, but I've always had these sounds in my head. And so when I went to Bay Beach for the first time, it kind of felt like, you know, I'd finally entered the park and kind of grown up in a way.
Well, for people who haven't been to Bay Beach, this is not an amusement park on the scale of a Six Flags or a Disney World.
And that's what makes it so cool. I mean, it's not pretending to be anything it isn't. And it has this small town charm to it. When you go to the park, you see all different kinds of people because it's so affordable and, you know, it's right on the water. It's the perfect summer getaway.
All right. So all of this might be a given, but when did this all translate into making music?
Yeah. So the first time I went to Bay Beach, I rode the Zip and Pippin because the Elvis connection. And for those who don't know, 8 days before Elvis Presley died, he rented Liberty Land, which was the former home of the Zip and Pippin in Memphis. And he rented Liberty Land from, I think it was 2 a.m. to 7 a.m. and entertained his group of guests that he brought along to the park. And he was decked out in the full Elvis attire. And he was eating those peanut butter and banana sandwiches he loved so much. And rode the Zip and Pippin all night, which I'm sure was just...
With all those peanut butter and banana sandwiches, it's an interesting thought. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, with that connection, I rode the Zip and Pippin, and I had that adrenaline rush that I hadn't had since, you know, I was a kid. You know, you kind of forget about amusement parks until one looks you straight in the eye. And so I rode it repeatedly over and over, and with each kind of pass, more lyrics came to me, and I set the song to that clickety-clack rhythm of that roller coaster. And it's kind of, in a way, how rock and roll music sounds. It has that that backbeat to it.
Well, it's interesting you talk about the adrenaline. This is not the biggest roller coaster in the world. It's far from the biggest roller coaster in the world. But it's a good reminder that, you know, the adrenaline doesn't just come from height and speed, but from the whole experience.
The whole experience, yeah. The experience of you don't know if this is going to crash or not.
Right, it's a wooden roller coaster.
Yeah, it's one of the oldest wooden roller coasters in America. And riding that thing, you do have this sense of what's going to happen. Which, you know, you go to Six Flags and they strap you in like you're flying to the moon or something. But at Bay Beach, you know, you feel like, I don't want to talk out of turn, but you feel like something could go wrong.
I feel like I almost don't want to tell this story, but my daughter rode the Zip and Pippin with my wife, and they got to the end of it, and my daughter realized that her harness had come undone and decided that she wasn't going to ride it again.
But yeah, it's just a thrill being at an amusement park, and the impetus for the whole project was, you know, riding the Zip and Pippin for the first time and then walking around the amusement park and thinking, well, this could be a song or that could be a song. So yeah, after the Zippin' Pippin' and playing it for a couple of years, with each summer I'd go back to the park and basically write a new song in my head while I was at the park and kind of just go home with another song. So it was pretty good deal. Go to the park, get a song.
50 cents.
Yeah.
It's interesting because one of the things that makes Bay Beach kind of stand out is that it's sort of frozen in time in that way. Or timeless is maybe the better way to put it. And the styles of music that are represented on this album kind of feel like that too.
Definitely. Bay Beach has been around for 125 years, and I just got off the phone with a fellow named Doug McGee, who's in the Friends of Bay Beach group, and you know, we were chatting about the park, and I asked him, how long have you been going to Bay Beach? And he said, since 1946. I thought, wow, got some time on me. But yeah, I wanted to capture that old school flavor without necessarily trying to catch that same lightning in a bottle that's on those early rhythm and blues, Elvis, Chuck Berry, Buddy Holly records, but just keep it in mind that we want to go down that path.
Well, right. The idea is not to sound like you're ripping them off, basically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a nod, I guess.
So I feel like at this point, we probably ought to hear another song from this album. What are you going to play?
We're going to do Bumper Cars, which was one of the last songs that I wrote for the album, and I wrote it in the midst of the last election, when we had all these different ideas and personalities and thoughts kind of just running into each other. And I thought it was kind of a perfect way to bring everybody on in one conversation, being in kind of the bumper cars.
The bumper car is a metaphor for the state of discourse in this country.
Exactly. Yeah, you said it much better than I could have. But yeah, we have all these different pop culture rivalries going at it in this song here. So it's called Bumper Cars. Here we go.
1, 2, 3, 4. Bumper cars. It don't matter who you are. Choose any car. Red, white, or blue, and you can choose who to hit, not who hits you. David and Goliath, the pimp and the priest, Hector and Achilles, Beauty and the Beast, Ollie and Frasier, Hamilton Burr, Cat and the Mouse, Batman, Joker, Jobs and Gates, Joan of Arc and the Brits. Down here everybody's gonna get hit. Bumper cars. It don't matter who you are. Choose any car, red, white, or blue, and you can choose who to hit, not who hits you. Jerry and Newman, Palmer and Jack, Alvy, Annie Hall, the Vikings and the Pack, the people and OJ, Potter and Malfoy, the Jedi and Sith, the Hatfields, McCoys, love and lust, the left and the right, all going at it on this floor tonight. Ba 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 bumper cars. It don't matter who you are. Choose any car, red, white, or blue, and you can choose who to hit, not who hits you. Got you bad, now I'm on the run. You want that sweet redemption. She came up from behind. I'll admit, I was blind. Bumper cars. It don't matter who you are. So come mothers, daughters, fathers, sons. You'll feel a lot better after you're done.
Bumper Cars, Trapper Shep off Bay Beach Amusement Park. Great song.
Yeah, if that was the synopsis of the album, you'll feel a lot better after you're done. Sort of cheaper than therapy, running cars into each other.
I have to say that that's probably the only song in the pop music canon that references Alvy and Annie Hall.
That's probably true. Yeah. The Annie Hall, how I got that line was, you know, Annie Hall's obviously one of my favorite movies, but he grew up by an amusement park. And so there's that great shot of him, I think, at his kitchen table eating cereal as a boy. And the whole room is just, like, shaking like crazy. But, yeah, there's a great shot of him in that movie in the bumper cars.
And if I remember, Annie Hall's from Wisconsin.
Yes, yeah. But, yeah.
It all comes full circle.
Bumper cars, it's all about equality. And everyone can play the game. And we're all in this together, as cliche as that sounds. We're all kind of going at it. On one night.
A lot of traffic.
Traffic.
Navigating through a pretty complicated world.
Yes.
You mentioned talking with the guy from the Friends of Bay Beach. We haven't really mentioned this. Bay Beach is actually a public park.
It is. And that, like the Green Bay Packers, it's publicly owned. And that was a big attraction to it for me as well. I'm the son of a park ranger. And I gravitate towards public spaces that everyone can be a part of. I think it's a really special part of America, you know, that we have these public facilities that we can all go to and be a part of. I was at Bay Beach this winter taking some photographs, and I couldn't believe in the middle of winter there were people snowshoeing, hiking, walking around this park. You know, it just has this draw that's so strange and fun.
Well, and there's a certain accessibility to the place that doesn't exist with Six Flags.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it hasn't always been like that. When Bay Beach was first came about, it was a really swampy area, and so they actually had to take a ferry in for people to ride the rides at the park. And one of the first rides in the park was sort of this, it's like a log chute ride, where you'd actually fly down this path and you'd go into the water. But we've come so far in our amusement parks, yet, you know, have stayed the same. And that's what's cool about Bay Beach is it's a throwback. And that was a big part of the attraction for me.
We can't let the opportunity go without referencing. I mean, you're here. You're wearing a shirt that says "The Scat is Where It's At," which is, in fact, the refrain from one of the songs on this album about
yes,
the Scat.
Yes, and I have these two tickets to the Green Bay Recreation Department Bay Beach Park here attached to the end of my guitar as well.
Well, and again, you mentioned the gentleman from the Friends of Bay Beach. What are the people at the amusement park itself think, or what did they say when they found out here's a guy who's making an album about the park?
Yeah, Jason Arnaldi, the director, when I first brought it up to him, he said, "You're going to do what?" And I kind of kept at the demos, and I'd sent it to them, and it was on their radar from the get-go. But as the project kind of progressed, people at the park got a little bit more involved. And, you know, I just got a call from Jason yesterday saying, "We're out of CDs at the park." You know, they have the CDs in the gift shop. So meta. They have the CDs. And I think people are just so thrilled that there's music to accompany this institution.
It's a little bit of pressure, though, I would have to think, like making sure that you're doing justice to this place that you love.
Yeah. You know, the album it's specific, but it's universal. And it's inspiration. So, you know, the songs about bumper cars, for instance, we've all ridden the bumper cars, the Ferris wheel, the Tilt-A-Whirl, they're all very familiar to people, even if they haven't been to Bay Beach. So Bay Beach was sort of the lens I was looking through, if you will, and was trying to keep it open so people all around the world could understand what I was going for.
Well, so you've got the album for sale at the Bay Beach gift shop. I mean, do you feel kind of in a way, are you sort of an unofficial ambassador to this park now?
That is what has been discussed, yeah. I just got back from playing about 30 shows all over America, talking about this album, playing the songs for people. And the really great thing about it has been, after the show, people coming up to me,
with their amusement park story, or you got to go to this amusement park. And we went to Cedar Point in Ohio, which is the roller coaster capital of the world. But, you know, that was our one off day on the tour, and we spent it, you know, running around Cedar Point. But that was all because someone came up to me at a show and said, you know, go to Cedar Point. So, yeah, it's an honor. It really is, in a way, to be associated with the park.
So you were talking about, at the start of this interview, the Zip and Pippin and how you rode it over and over and over again. Tilt-A-Whirl features a character who's riding the Tilt-A-Whirl over and over again because he wants to be near the Tilt-A-Whirl operator. This brings us to the most obvious of the songs that involves riding something over and over again, which is Ferris Wheel, which I think is what you're going to play us out with.
Yeah, Ferris Wheel is the story of these two brothers who come to the amusement park with their family, and they board the Ferris Wheel, and they get to the very top, and they say in unison, "We wish this never ends," and it sort of ignites the Ferris Wheel. It makes it take on this supernatural energy where it never stops, and wherein all of these wild scenes happen, which you can see in the album art of the family that moves their trailer into the amusement park to be with their family. It's all about this dysfunctional family and what they do when their sons get stuck forever on a Ferris wheel. So,
well, before you play it, let me just say the great thing about this album is it lets us relive the experience of Bay Beach over and over again.
Yes. Thank you so much, Mitch. Thank you for your enthusiasm and interest in the album. It's pretty weird.
Well, job well done.
Thank you. All right, this is Ferris Wheel.
Trapper Shep with Tanner Shep playing us out with Ferris Wheel from his EP, Bay Beach Amusement Park. The former Lake Effect producer plays at TOSA tonight this evening at Hart Park. The opening act is none other than Lake Effect contributor Mike Mangione.
Let me tell you the story of two young brothers who came on a sunny day. They kissed their mama and papa and ripped two tickets, boarded the beast.
And that's Wednesday's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please be with us tomorrow morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.
Their wish came true, and their wish came true. The wheel went on and on. The boys still smile every time at the top. On the Ferris wheel that never stops. They called in the firefighters and the GBPD, but nobody could slow it down. When the FBI came, they turned off the power, but it still went round and round. As a crane went up, the wheel got faster. It